This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Well, it may be true that we are what we eat, but my guest today argues that as Americans, we are not eating what we truly are. We are a nation that owns 94,000 miles of coastline and has jurisdiction over more ocean than any country in the world. And yet more than 85% of our seafood is imported. Much of our seafood is from Asia. Some of it is even caught on our shores and sent to Asia for processing and then sent back. These are all examples of what Paul Greenberg describes as the unraveling of America's seafood economy. Paul's an author and essayist who spent years writing about the connection between seafood, the environment, and the economy. He's in town for this weekend's Farm to Fork Festival that celebrates sustainable farming in North Carolina, and here with me today on the studio. That's my name and the studio together.
Well, it's great to be with both of you today.
It's an economy measure. Paul Greenberg, tell us about this concept of the Great American Fish Swap, which was the subject of your first book.
Yeah, so in American Catch, what I came across was this really striking statistic, which is that, you know, the U.S. controls more ocean than any country on Earth, and yet, you know, more than 85% of our seafood is imported from abroad. And, you know, it seems like, okay, it must just be because we don't have enough fish. But actually, it turns out that we actually export about a third of what we catch, about 3 billion pounds. So we're sending all this very nice wild seafood abroad. And in return, we're getting back a lot of farmed stuff, mostly from Asia.
Yeah, that's the other big part of this point. We're sending away the good stuff and taking back some stuff that's not as high quality.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we send abroad is, frankly, fishier fish, you know, things like black cod, also known as sable fish, was very oily fish, but also high in omega-3s, mackerel, a huge export commodity, squid, those things we send abroad. And then in return, we get what, you know, one fishmonger once said to me that for Americans, fish is a dough delivery system. So, you know, shrimp, tilapia, it really, for most Americans, doesn't matter what they taste like. It's just, can you fry it?
Well, and wild-caught salmon is something else. I mean,
yes.
Again, that we send away the wild stuff, and then what we eat is domesticated, farm raised.
Yeah, so
right?
we export about 80% of the wild salmon that we catch, whereas about two-thirds of what we actually eat is farmed, often from Chile. And I should say that salmon are not even native to the Southern Hemisphere. So we have this other country farming what's essentially an invasive species and then exporting back to us. But there's another aspect to this, which you alluded to in your opening remarks, which is that a certain portion of the wild salmon in America is frozen at sea where it's caught in Alaska, sent to China or to Thailand or to Vietnam, defrosted, boned, filleted, refrozen, and then sent back to us double frozen.
That makes no sense. But it does make sense because it's actually cheaper, right?
It is cheaper. I mean, the huge difference is the cost of labor.
Yeah.
And, you know, I recently posted this on Twitter you know, people chimed in. And one processor chimed in from Sitka, Alaska, said, you know, look, we're one of the few processors that does process ourselves, but it costs us about three times as much as if sending it to China.
All right. So in terms of some of the quality, this idea of freezing, refreezing, thawing, and bringing it back, that's a cost issue. Then you suggested that the market, maybe just Americans don't like that much fish. So what are we losing here? If we don't like it, then it's working out fine for everybody.
Well, I mean, we as a nation, we still consume quite a bit of fish. I mean, the average American only eats about 15 pounds of seafood per person per year. Compare that to China, to Korea, to Japan, where it's like 30 pounds, 35, 40 pounds. So individually, we're not so fishy, but collectively, we are fishy. And we do need a lot of seafood in our diet. And, you know, yet again, you know, we're exporting all of this nice wild product abroad. So I think, you know, definitely a corrective of some kind is in order.
Well, let's talk about that, because you can see in that example of shipping fish to be processed and sending back, in that one case,
yep,
it is economically better to do that if money is all you're worried about. How about the big picture in all of this fish swap? How do we end up, and what's the economic impact on the U.S.?
Well, the big picture is that we're losing working waterfronts. And I personally think it's very good to have a working waterfront. It is part of having the infrastructure to feed yourself. But once you start having your fish processed in Asia or wherever, you lose the fish processing houses. You lose the skill. And it is a skill to cut fish in a decent way. And you lose the ability to take a fish from the boat to the plate. And to me, that leads to a giant food insecurity moment. And, you know, And the thing is that it's only expanding in this country. Now, just recently heard that a certain amount of chicken is starting to go abroad for processing. So I think we really have to kind of keep our infrastructure in place. As one fishmonger said to me, you hear stories about fish houses, fish processing houses being turned into resort hotels all the time, but you never hear of a hotel being turned into a fish house.
Well, and I think this, again, is a kind of a degrees of separation, but it also keeps the money circulating locally so that you can talk about spending less on fish because it costs you less to do that, but those even those fewer dollars you're spending are going to shareholders abroad.
That's right.
And then if you have an unemployment problem in your state that leads to all kinds of social and other state costs and public costs, well, you can bring those down if you start paying people a decent wage and generating industries that recirculate the dough.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I should say there is one other aspect to this, which is that, you know, we as a nation, in addition to shipping all of our processing overseas, we don't have any kind of fish farming or aquaculture sector to speak of. Right now, when you compare all the other aquaculture nations of the world, we rank about 16th, you know, behind that economic powerhouse of Myanmar. So we don't seem to want to devote coastal infrastructure to doing things like growing oysters, which is very ecologically beneficial, mussels, all these kinds of things that we could be growing. Instead, we're importing a lot of this farm product from places that do have an aquaculture sector.
Stay with oysters for a minute, because you say that's a clear metaphor for America's indifference about the oceans in general, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, look at an oyster. I mean, it's an amazing biological creature. It can filter 30 to 50 gallons of water per oyster per day. And, you know, once upon a time, my hometown, New York City, had trillions of oysters, and it was said that they turned over the entire water column every couple of weeks. So this incredible biological engine that also provides infrastructure for fish. I mean, oysters build in three dimensions. They basically build fish condos. And if you have oyster reef in place, you're going to have more fish. We have lost huge amounts of oyster producing territory all up and down the East Coast and on the West Coast as well. We're starting to get it back, largely as a result of the Clean Water Act and because of investment again into that kind of thing. But it's, you know, we got a long way to go.
When you talk about ecological issues too, preserving the coastline, the water quality and all these kinds of questions, it's kind of interesting in this case, if you preserve the waterfront industries, the fishing industries, you build in the industry itself has a stake in a clean environment. I mean, say, unlike the energy industry,
that's
where
right.
There's a real tension between environmentalists and shareholders on the energy industry because extraction is the deal. If your business depends on fish and clean water, I've got environmentalists who are working in the business. I can walk away from it.
That's right. And, you know, some people see this as like a weird alliance that, you know, fishermen who are taking fish out of the water could possibly be in the same room as environmentalists. But I've been really inspired by people in the Riverkeeper and the Waterkeeper movement, the alliance that of nonprofits around the country that do this kind of coastal protection, that more and more there is alliances built between fishermen because, you know, clean water, good estuaries, functioning underwater infrastructure, these are all things that support fishing, but they're also things that support clean water, bird life, all these kinds of things that everybody loves and that really we should be investing in as consumers as well as just, you know, nonprofit activists.
Well, you document some noteworthy examples of people trying to rebuild the seafood infrastructure in the U.S. Tell us more about that.
Well, there are a few different things going on. One of the things is a movement of more direct consumer-to-fisherman connections. In some cases, it's like you have down here Walking Fish, a community-supported fishery in which you can actually buy a share in a fishery at the beginning of the season. But there are all kinds of models. And in fact, actually, I was helping put together a new website. I didn't do it, but an organization put together a site called localcatch.org, which has basically put all online all the ways that you can access local seafood throughout the country. So we gave them a little bit of financial support, but they're really, really are ways now to connect with a local fisherman, even online.
You say Alaska is kind of way ahead of the game on this because of the intellectual and the political infrastructure that is built in around this.
Well, so, all right. On the one hand, they're really far ahead in terms of the management of wild fisheries. They have huge very, very valuable wild fisheries. And in fact, one of the reasons that Alaska sued for statehood in the first place was because their fisheries were being destroyed by people outside of the state. They took control of the state. They got statehood. They put in sustainable management practices. And because their fisheries are so valuable, they can reinvest that money into really, really sound management. I mean, if you're out fishing beyond the time when a, you know, salmon fishery closes, you've got your nets out 1 minute beyond, a helicopter will drop out of the sky and give you a $2,000 ticket. You know, if we could have that kind of really good management and enforcement and cooperative management between fishermen and regulators throughout this country, you know, we would be a better place.
So where that works for the fishing industry is there tension in the sports fishing world,
right,
in Alaska?
There is tension in the sport fishing world, particularly having to do with halibut, for example. Like, lots of guys like to go sport fishing and haul up that big old halibut, you know, and they take the picture and, you know, well, I go to Alaska just for the halibut kind of, you know, badge. But I mean,
that joke gave me a headache.
but I mean, in general, there's much more tension between anglers and commercial fishermen outside of Alaska. I mean, here in North Carolina, it's a big deal. In North Carolina and throughout the Southeast, you know, things like Red Drum, Red Snapper, these are always places where the sport guys want a bigger quota. The commercial guys want to keep the quota that they've got, and they come to blows.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about the North Carolina scene and keep you with us. Paul Greenberg, the author, essayist, whose most recent book is American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. He's in town for this weekend's Farm to Fork events, and he's going to stay with us as we continue our conversation and take a look at the North Carolina coast on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Eddie Willis is a fourth-generation fisherman who spent almost every day of his life on the water. Got his first pole when he was 6, had his own motorboat by the time he was 8. By the time he was 13, he was spending far more time fishing than at school, and eventually took over the family business. But about 10 years ago, he began to notice that many of his fellow fishermen were leaving their lives on the water. Increasing imports, rising fuel prices, a changing global market, all that continued to threaten their livelihood. And he realized that if he was going to keep going in his business, he'd have to adapt to the changing economy. He built his own ice room. He started to vertically integrate his business. And then a few years later, created one of the first community-supported fishery organizations in North Carolina. He's going to be part of a panel at the Farm to Fork this weekend that explores the seafood economy in North Carolina. But first, joins me in the studio, Eddie Willis. Welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
So tell us how you got started, a bit of your family history on the water, and then when you started fishing.
Well, I was a fourth-generation commercial fisherman, great-grandfather, grandfather and father, and just as a small boy, just fell in love with it. It was exciting and, you know, just a way of life for us, and got in it at a very young age and part-time, and then, like you say, later on, you know, got in it full-time, and that's all I've ever done. I've never had a job and just always fish for a living.
Did you first start going out on those commercial boats, or did you just kind of drop a line? How did you get going?
No, I started out wholeheartedly on the commercial boat and with Dad, more or less just a deckhand, you know, culling shrimp and picking fish, and later on in life just, you know, took over the family business and went from there.
But you were off on your own now and then. Tell us about your adventures as an 8-year-old.
Well, I was so young, I wasn't allowed to go alone. So they hired a gentleman out of the neighborhood that had retired to go with me. And they paid him my hourly wage to just more or less keep me from drowning and making sure I didn't do anything too crazy. And we got to making so much more money that he abandoned the hourly wage and said, "Hey, I want a share, or I'm going to quit."
So, this is just you and a pole casting?
Is us with nets. Us with shrimp nets, gill nets, crab pots, you know, et cetera.
You're 8 years old or so,
yeah,
right?
8, 9, yeah.
And you're already bringing in a haul that is commercially viable. So you stayed with it, as did a lot of folks down along the water, but then you started to notice people were leaving the business. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the business was just slowly slipping away, people quitting and just giving it up because, you know, lack of interest and being able to make a living. And I started looking around, you know, the island and what was going on, and I said, I've got to change something here. I got to the days of just going to the commercial fish house and dumping it off is over with, and I've got to seek larger and better markets. And
so what'd you do?
So I, like I said, I built an ice house and built a seafood market and started retailing my own catch, and was lucky, had some older fish dealers take me under their wing and kind of guide me, and we branched out to the markets, you know, the Fulton Market and in New York and just other markets like that, and got to ship in our stuff from Atlanta clear to New York to any and everybody that had money.
Well, you heard Paul Greenberg say earlier that a lot of fish houses get converted to hotels, but you don't hear it going in the other direction. There might be good reasons why people haven't done what you did. I mean, it's hard to make that work, isn't it?
It's a lot of hours. It's a commitment. It really is. When you've been on the water 10, 12 hours and you get home and you've got 6 more hours to get it washed and packed and ready to go off to, you know, to some wholesaler, that it makes you stop and think, is this really worth it? But in the end, it is.
You said that things have really changed in terms of the mentality of people who do your business, fisher people, that it was all about volume when you were young and things have changed. Tell us about that.
Well, I was brought up on volume. I mean, if you didn't sell 3-4 million pounds of stuff a year, you were nobody. You know, you just didn't work. And now we take just a few thousand pounds or even times a few hundred pounds and make a really good living off of it. But we're kind of outside the box of most people because we seek out the niche markets and, you know, and quality is everything. Quality sells itself. You don't have to sell quality.
Well, I was going to say, because if it's cheaper to catch, freeze, ship, refreeze, you know, bone and send it back, you, in terms of price, you're not competing there, are you?
No. Well, like I say, we're outside the box because we do all that ourselves. We have a bunch of supermarkets, restaurants we you know cater to, and like I say, we also have the CSF where we do the individual shareholders.
That's community supported fish, like community supported agriculture. Right.
We last year alone, I think we fed like 300 people a week, and had 3 grocery stores and about a dozen restaurants that we cater to every week. Plus, we fished and wholesaled what we didn't send out to the, you know, the restaurants and the individual people.
But it is really a lot of market building. I belong to a CSF here. It's called Walking Fish, through Duke University, and brings up fish every week from the water. And I got a real education because, you know, triggerfish and red drum and fish that I hadn't eaten, like mackerel, and thought it was cat food, and then realized, what am I missing all my life, right? But if I hadn't had access to that, I never would have known what I was missing. And then and also sent me to the internet looking up recipes, because who knew what to do with that stuff?
Right.
It's all good. So it's a big challenge building those markets. Let's find out more about this and what all is involved by a few other participants in this weekend's seafood panel. Barbara Garrity Blake is a cultural anthropologist who has documented and written about North Carolina's coastal traditions for more than 2 decades, and she joins us from Mount Airy, North Carolina. Hello, Barbara.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm also joined by John Day, Vice President of NC Catch. He also works for the Center for Environmental Farming Systems. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And author Paul Greenberg is still with us. Barbara, let me ask you a little to give us kind of an overview about the fishing culture on the coast. Tell us kind of what it is now, maybe a brief look at how it's changed over time.
Sure. You know, I live actually very close to Eddie. He's on Harker's Island, and I'm in Gloucester, in the down east part of Carteret County, and I've been there, gosh, almost 30 years now, and I've seen so much change. Since 2000, there are just about half as many licensed and active commercial fishermen than there used to be, so that's a pretty stark shift right there. I have worked with Sea Grant and done some inventories of fish houses, you know, the processing and packing facilities. In the last 15 years, we've seen the processing capacity be reduced by about a third on the coast.
Let me stop you there, because obviously we're talking about what that means to the economy, the industry. But in terms of that part of North Carolina, what kind of changes does that mean to just culturally? What's it like to live down there, and how has that changed?
Well, it's actually, you know, it's been quite a stark change. Where Eddie and I live down east, all those communities from Harker's Island down to Cedar Island were just revolved around commercial fishing and wooden boat building and crab pot making and net building. So it was very much a water-dependent economy. Now it's just, I'd say the towns are a lot quieter. There are retirees that have moved into the area. You know, in along the coast in general, we've gone to more of a service industry, of course, so tourism is big. The real estate boom that occurred during the early 2000s brought about a lot of changes. That's when a lot of the fish houses were sold because coastal property values were going through the roof. And these fish houses are located on deep water ports, which are, you know, very coveted among those that would like to have a high dollar marina.
Well, John, let me ask you, John Day, who's vice president of NC Catch, you know, in terms of, you know, the best use of dollars, I mean, if you're looking at these kind of economic pressures, I mean, the first question is it a wise thing to preserve this, and how would you do it if you want to preserve this industry?
Well, look at any thing that needs help being preserved, any historic structure or things that represent what was important to us and what made us what we are. That's one of the reasons. This is a way of life in that part of the state, and it's up everywhere on in coastal areas that is under so much duress and pressure, much of it from imports, not just regulation, but imports have made an incredible impact negatively on the lives of people in that business. It is worth preserving, if for no other reason, because it's our heritage. But it's also worth preserving because it's really good food, and you can't get it anywhere else like that. I mean, we were talking a little bit earlier, Paul and us, about farmed fish, and there are some successes with it, but it still doesn't taste the same. It's not the same thing. I mean, it has a role, certainly, but it's different.
Paul Greenberg, give us a sense of where North Carolina is in the national picture in terms of kind of where it is today, but also in efforts to preserve the industry.
Well, I mean, it's very indicative of the country at large in the sense that, you know, increasingly with these great food-producing bread baskets or fish baskets of our country, instead of people running markets, we're letting markets run people. You know, if people could vote with their hearts rather than their wallets, what they want are working fishing communities, working, you know, vineyards, working beautiful, you know, functioning food systems. That's what they want. But again and again, we let the markets run us. What I see happening in North Carolina, though, is, you know, it's really the epicenter of the relocalization movement in seafood. You know, you mentioned Walking Fish, which I'm glad to hear you belong to, and probably I'll go over to your house for triggerfish later.
it's mackerel this week.
Oh, mackerel this week. Yeah, yeah. I can't keep track. but, you know, there really is, I think people are waking up. It's like when things slip away, fish house by fish house, boat by boat, fisherman by fisherman, you know, it's sort of people don't really notice it. But at a certain point, you hit a tipping point and you're like, whoa, the character of this coast, the character of this region is changing. And we have to actually, again, people have to run the markets instead of letting the markets run the people and intercede. And I think that's what's happening in North Carolina.
Well, Eddie Willis, when you decided to take up this cause, which I think, you know, a lot of people were just leaving. So they sort of, you know, answered the question, do you want to save this industry and do the kinds of things you did? Did people say you were crazy? How do they react to the initial plan to say, I'm going to do something about this?
I really don't know what the public perception was of that. We kind of just jumped in and did our own thing and let it go where it did, you know, because I was handling my own stuff and I wasn't really obligated to anyone else or anyone else's opinion about what I was doing. Now, later on in life, I started buying from other fishermen and you know, had more people come in and saw that it was a viable way, and there was more money to be made this way than it was the way we were doing it. And
so is it scalable? Is this something that you could build, I mean, a sort of a cooperative where you can integrate vertically? And
yes, this can grow. The main thing is you've got to find fishermen that are willing to go the extra step. I mean, there's a lot more to this way than just catching it and coming home and it being over with. I mean, you have a lot of extra work, a lot of extra hours, and there's days you're packing fish and you've got a phone to your ear and you're marketing it at the same time, and you know, or you're on the boat catching the fish and you're figuring out where you're going with it as you're catching it. You know, many hours later you get home with it, but you've sold it before you get home, and And that's key to it.
Well, Barbara, you know, part of your work has documented the menhaden industry, which used to be a big part of the North Carolina fishing scene. And just the story of the menhaden fishing industry is some way illustrative of perhaps where we are today, is it?
I think so. You know, as you might know, menhaden is an oily, bony herring fish that isn't considered a food fish. So it's factory reduced into fish meal and oil. And so I came to Carteret County on the coast to study this. There was one factory left in Beaufort Fisheries. And I was interested in this. It was just, you know, the crewmen are largely African American, and, you know, they have large fishing vessels, and the fish was factory processed. Today, that is now a high-dollar recreational marina. There's no more menhaden processing in North Carolina. Like a lot of things, we now import a lot of fish meal. Fish meal is used in the livestock, mainly poultry, but now also increasingly in the aquaculture industry. If you remember a few years ago, there was a problem of pet food where domestic dogs and cats were dying from pet food that was using meal imported from China. And it turns out the Chinese were using a synthetic protein called melamine.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was basically poisoning pets. Right. And to me, that was an important lesson because we knew where our fish meal was coming from. We knew the menhaden was caught right off here. It was a healthy product. And just because of, you know, well, complicated reasons, the industry's gone from North Carolina.
Right, but it's another example of how you can integrate. I mean, North Carolina agriculture is, you know, the most or one of the most important industries in the entire state. You're on a farm-to-fork conference that for this year is now including the fishing industry. Imagine if that had been part of the equation and we were using local fish to help the local farm economy that then, I mean, on and on. Again, you can see how these circulations are important, and if you let one end collapse, there's a lot of trouble all the way around. But John, let me talk about what, you know, Eddie's point that it takes a lot of extra work. People are sort of working outside their expertise to build it. Is this just a question of time and scale? Do you get, if this keeps working, can you finally hire the experts so that you're not on the phone with your market out on the boat catching the fish?
Well, I think that's probably the hope of a lot of people. It's the same in any sort of small scale, locally produced food. You know, I work with dairy farmers and cattle farmers too, and they're not marketing people, and you know, they don't have time to do that sort of thing. If they do, they live a life kind of like Eddie, where he doesn't get to sleep very much. Yeah. And I've seen him that way; it's terrible. But that's what it takes because they don't have the money because there's so much pressure on price to sell their product through a normal outlet. They've got to develop those markets for it, just like Eddie was talking about. So it becomes exceedingly difficult to make that work. But as I was saying earlier about the pressure from imports, they're so inexpensive compared to anything local. And we, as Americans, really like to get a bargain. I work with national food service companies in their area as well as grocery stores. And they tell me their sweet spot for selling – this is a food service company – their sweet spot for selling fish fillets is $7.99 to $9.99 a pound. Eddie's got that much money in it when he goes to sell it. You know, so how can you make that work? And that's the pressure of imports. It's the same thing if you go to buy grass-fed beef or something from a small rancher around here or cattle farmer. It does cost more because it costs more to raise it and have a quality product like that. And they're doing it on a small scale. But people realize – if I know that farm, I understand the quality of the product I'm buying. I know it's safe to eat. And if you're buying imported seafood, I'm sorry, you don't know it's safe to eat.
Well, and there's a whole other sort of ethical issue with imported seafood. As you know, I think you might have read in the AP and the Guardian, it was a huge story last year that the Thai seafood industry has huge connections to forced labor, you know, slavery, in other words. And it was a lot of that was connected to shrimp and to the feed, you know, the ground up wild fish that are ground up and turned into the meal that are then fed to shrimp that are then sent to us. So, you know, yeah, the difference between grass-fed American beef and lot-fed American beef is, you know, one deal. But American seafood versus, like, imported seafood, that could have been farmed under really dubious ethical situations? I mean, that's pretty profound.
Well, and again, the short-term gain that you might reap at the checkout counter versus the long-term costs of allowing unemployment, of allowing industries to go begging while your dollars float abroad to foreign shareholders.
That's right.
That's expensive, and it leads to enormous social costs that you will pay on tax day if you don't pay it at the cash register. But, Paul, talk about is it sustainable? I mean, there are not a lot of Eddie Willises in the world, it seems.
Yeah.
And so can you really scale this up and make it sustainable?
Well, it's tough. And it's also another important statistic to look at is that in the last 30 to 40 years, the seafood trade has gone from 80% local fish market and 20% supermarket to flipped, like 80% supermarket, 20% local fishmongers. And it's really hard. And also, I should say, you know, like most guys, I don't know, I think Eddie would probably agree, like if you like to fish, you're not necessarily the kind of guy who wants to be on the phone talking to customers. It's just like not part of you. The whole reason you go fishing in the first place is I don't want to talk to anyone.
I wish you could have seen Eddie's face just now.
You know,
giant eye roll.
I don't want to talk to anyone. And, you know, it's like, that's fine. I mean, that's cool. But you have to, you know, you do today have to make that extra step. But there are some interesting things going on. Like I know out in Portland, they're doing something called the Red, which is like a sort of collecting station for processing for multiple people. So maybe that's the solution, is that you have little hubs set up for a collective of local fishermen.
We will stay tuned. Thank you, Paul Greenberg, award-winning author and essayist. Barbara Garrity Blake, a cultural anthropologist, author of Fish Factory. John Day is vice president of NC Catch. And Eddie Willis, fourth-generation fisherman and founder of Core Sound Seafood. My guest will participate in events and a conversation tomorrow at the Rick House in Durham, part of the weekend's Farm to Fork events. You can find out about all the books these folks have written and the event at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the cinematic folk music of Songs of Water. Stay tuned.